Talking History on News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're debating Irish foreign policy in the first part of the 1960s as we look at Ireland's first term on the UN Security Council during the Cuban Missile Crisis, talk about spies and diplomacy, and find out about the controversy over whether Guinness was a food or a drink. Last week, we discussed the political rebel, human rights champion and radical feminist who was ahead of her time, Sylvia Pankhurst, studied what revolutions around the world have in common, and reviewed a new crime novel set in Ireland during the War of Independence. And if you want to listen back to this or any of our older shows, just go to our website, newstalk.com, or wherever you download your podcasts. In tonight's show, we're looking at Irish foreign policy between 1961 and 1965 to coincide with the publication of Volume 12 of the Royal Irish Academy's magnificent series, Documents on Irish Foreign Policy. The volume includes new material on Ireland's first time on the UN Security Council, during which they had to deal with events like the Cuban Missile Crisis, and we also get a new insight into our attempts to join the EEC and relations with Britain and Northern Ireland. So, to discuss Irish foreign policy in the first part of the 1960s, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts, the team behind Volume 12 of the Documents on Irish Foreign Policy series. Dr. Michael Kennedy is the executive editor of the Documents on Irish Foreign Policy series and is a leading expert in Irish military and diplomatic history, as well as Irish foreign policy. Professor Bernadette Whelan is Professor Emeritus at the University of Limerick and is an expert on US-Irish diplomatic relations, and her new book is De Valera and Roosevelt, Irish and American Diplomacy in Times of Crisis. Dr. John Gibney is Assistant Editor with the Royal Irish Academy's Documents on Irish Foreign Policy series and is an expert on Restoration Ireland, Irish historiography and the Irish Revolution. Dr. Owen Kinsella was Assistant Editor with the Royal Irish Academy's Documents on Irish Foreign Policy series for Volume 12 and is now working with the Defence Forces for the centenary of its formation. Professor Eunan O'Halpin is Professor Emeritus of Contemporary Irish History at Trinity College Dublin and is the author of Kevin Barry, An Irish Rebel in Life and Death, and the co-author of The Dead of the Irish Revolution. Well, you're all very welcome. And Michael, I might begin with you, and I might begin with Ireland's first time on the UN Security Council, because last month Ireland took its place for the fourth time. So take us back to 1962, when Ireland had a seat on the Security Council for the first time.
First term of the Security Council, unlike at the moment, was a one-year term. It was a shared term with Liberia, who had just vacated the seat at the end of 1961. And this had come about through a compromise deal, as things often do in the UN, way back 2 years before that, where there was uncertainty as to who was to go forward. And in looking for a neutral candidate, an independent candidate, Ireland's name came up. And very much against the expectations of the Department of External Affairs, Ireland found itself in January 1962 at the UN's top table, with the seat at the top table. And for Ireland, this was a big step forward in UN policy, that Ireland had been very active in the UN since membership in 1955. And really, the late 50s, the early 60s have seen increased activism in the Assembly, involvement in peacekeeping, the Congo, later Cyprus, and Irish, not only soldiers on peacekeeping missions, but Conor Cruise O'Brien as Ireland's representative in Katanga. Fred Boland, who I want to come to really now, with Ireland's ambassador to the UN, had been playing a huge role in the General Assembly. On Dag Hammarskjöld's death in Katanga, Boland was touted as a possible Secretary General replacing Dag Hammarskjöld, but with the agreement of Minister Frank Aiken, he turned the post down. And it's he who takes Ireland's seat on the Security Council in January 1962. It's a moment of huge importance for UN policy for Ireland, because it's kind of an affirmation of the activist independent role that Ireland had at the UN in the recent years. And it's an affirmation of Frank Aiken's view that Ireland can be a force for good as a small state in the UN, can try and seek to ameliorate Cold War tensions, can act as a broker, can act as a middle power in the UN, and can try and represent the wishes of the Assembly, the myriad of states in the UN, on the Security Council, and try maybe to stand up to the great powers, to the permanent members of the Council, and to try and broker compromises and so on. So it really is a crowning moment of early Irish United Nations policy.
And everything you say there sounds wonderful in principle. How successful was Ireland in carrying out that mission? Was it a voice for the smaller nations? Did it succeed in being a force for good on the Security Council?
I think it did succeed as being a force for good, in that it was able to broker compromise, it was able to act bringing powers together, it was able to act in kind of discussions off the horseshoe-shaped council table. And here is where I'm relying on reading between the lines and documents, because so much Security Council work is done in corridors, it's done in stairwells, it's done increasingly in informal meetings, although that wasn't necessarily always happening in 1962. So what Ireland tried to do was to influence the big states. And I think it's, if you look at this period, Ireland's biggest achievement, although it's not necessarily through the Security Council, is through getting the resolution in December 1961 that leads into the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty of 1968. So, I mean, taking that in context, Ireland is able to persuade the UN if there is a possibility of brokering a compromise. That's Ireland's view. We will get in there, and we have the wiggle room as a small state to try and persuade the greater powers to come round to what is hopefully in their best interest.
And Bernadette, of course, during this time then, we have the Cuban Missile Crisis, and that becomes a particularly hot topic. And talk to me about the insights that we get from some of the documents here, because there's even an issue over Shannon and the searching of flights.
Correct. I think one of the more interesting aspects of the period is that while the Irish-American relationship in general, when we look at it from a strategic perspective, we find that Ireland has very little prominence or place in US Cold War priorities or in the transatlantic relationship in strategic terms. And that changes really with the Cuban Missile Crisis, because it is then that we have the Canadians in relation to Gander and the Irish in relation to Shannon are being asked by the Americans and then also by the British about to try and assist and provide information about communist flights that are going to and from Cuba, perhaps laden with, you know, whatever types of armaments, etc., or military personnel. And indeed, that request, it comes quite forcefully from through the American ambassador as to whether the Irish would consider stopping the flights and searching the flights. Now, what Lamass agrees to at the time is that they would exchange technical information around the frequency of flights, whether they were scheduled or non-scheduled. And so that information was supplied by the Department of Transport to the Americans and obviously to the British as well. So Ireland's strategic importance in that global context that Michael was just explaining really is increased during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
And Bernadette, do you think Ireland was able to play an important role during the Cuban Missile Crisis using its position on the Security Council?
Yeah, I mean, within the Security Council itself, I think Ireland's position as this in attempting to have this independent voice, but at the same time, a pro-US stance, we find that the Irish voice is listened to in many ways because, as Michael has described there, it had become and was increasingly seen as this kind of almost honest broker, albeit that Lamass, of course, is strongly pro-US and it becomes one of the features of Ireland's foreign policy at the United Nations.
Eunan, I'm wondering who's driving Irish foreign policy in this period. Is it the Taoiseach Sean Lamass or is it the Minister for External Affairs, Frank Aiken?
Well, I think that in some ways there's a twin track policy. Aiken continues to have a great deal of involvement on the UN side, and clearly that's where his heart lies. But it's also clear that you can even see it in the documents and generally that Lamass has taken control of the European negotiations, and he's not going to let anything stand in the way of those negotiations. So in a sense, you'd have to say that Lamass is definitely the dominant figure in things that, in his view, really matter in relation to Europe, especially.
And Eunan, what do you see as the great value of a series like Documents on Irish Foreign Policy? Is it aimed at scholars? Is it aimed at interested members of the public? Because the fact is that you're suddenly now able to bring to the public all of these documents and that allow new insights into periods of Irish history that we didn't have before.
Well, I think that the value of the collection is partly, I hope, not simply in the fact that it's published, and also now that volumes go online after a period, which means that they're accessed across the world. I mean, Michael Kennedy has collected extraordinary data on usage over time in different parts of the world. But it's also that we have to remember that other countries do this as well. And to some extent, were it not that this project was in operation, we would be very much at a loss as compared, for example, with British records, which are prodigious, or indeed American records, although they're kind of hard to navigate, to get, if you like, the Irish side of Irish diplomacy. So and although the material lies in the National Archives, who are extraordinarily helpful, we've seen fortuitously, in a sense, the fact that we have got online with volumes up to the early 1950s, given the COVID disaster, it shows you the unexpected additional power, if you like, that this medium has given us. But I do think that while we select documents, but for the documents we select, we leave 10 or 20 that we don't choose. And I think for any serious scholar, on the one hand, the collection is enormously important, be he or she a scholar of Irish diplomacy, of small state diplomacy, of European affairs or whatever. But it's also important to realise that behind those documents come from more extensive records. And really, it's by exploring those records that real scholarship in depth can be carried out. I'm not saying that our volumes aren't useful, but in some ways they are only the tip of a research iceberg.
And John Gibney, it's fascinating when you look at some of the documents that don't relate to high politics or huge international interests, that some of those are incredibly fascinating, including the discussion over whether Guinness was a food or a drink.
Yeah, it's worth picking up on something that Ewan said there. And, you know, and obviously many countries have comparable projects to documents in Irish foreign policy, and that other countries publish the archival record of their own foreign relations. But there's a key in the name. Like, it's not documents in Irish foreign relations, it's documents in Irish foreign policy. So the documents are, I suppose, chosen on the basis that it's a question of, you know, what do they show? How do they illustrate how decisions were ultimately made? But there's many other avenues that can be explored in the archival collection in the National Archives. And I mean, I don't view it as purely diplomatic history. I mean, my view of it is that it's essentially Irish history through the lens of diplomacy, because the Irish diplomatic service, for I suppose most of its existence, and certainly up to the period that the series has covered so far, was relatively small, which meant that they had to cover a lot of bases. And even before we get to the question of whether Guinness is a food or a drink, it's worth bearing in mind that it's not just necessarily the material related to high politics that appears in the collection. I mean, in the volumes on the Second World War, this is just one example, but copious amounts of eyewitness reports from Irish diplomats who were present in occupied Europe. So you do have a view from the ground that otherwise wouldn't necessarily be there. And while I mentioned that the guiding principle relates to, say, you know, choosing documents to illustrate how decisions were made, the volumes do contain a lot of material that applies to, say, social history, economic history, not just political history, cultural history as well to a certain extent, material relating to the Irish diaspora, trade, and the issue you raise about whether or not Guinness could be classed as a food or a drink, you know, that's an issue that relates to economic history, to the economics of Anglo-Irish trade in the 60s, and by extension, Irish Anglo-Irish relations in a political dimension as well. So the volumes, I mean, Ewan is right. I mean, the volumes can only contain a certain amount out of what are still very, very large archives. But they do contain a lot of material that it's essentially a resource for Irish history more broadly. And it is worth stressing that it is a public resource. The material, while it's published in hard copy volumes initially, it does go online. And one thing I should point out about the DIFP website is that it's open access. There's no subscription, there's no paywall, and the material is there to be used in as widely and as broadly as possible. That doesn't answer whether Guinness is a food or a drink, but that's a question we may yet tease out.
What did they decide in the 1960s about Guinness?
I think, as my recollection, there was more proposal to reclassify Guinness as a food stuff, based on my recollection, in order to get around the possibility of a tariff charge while entering the British market.
And Owen, it's interesting when you look at aspects like the repatriation of the remains of Roger Casement, that some incredible documents here, including an eyewitness account of the exhumation.
That's right. It goes into, I suppose, an extraordinary level of detail about how they actually went around not just approaching the British government in the first instance to get permission to exhume the remains and bring them back to Ireland, and also those kind of back channel and background discussions about what would happen to the body when it came back. And there was a little bit of nervousness on the part of the British government that there would be, I suppose, a very public spectacle made of reinterring him somewhere in Belfast or somewhere that might present potential difficulties for both governments, but not least the British. So the actual eyewitness account gives you a huge level of detail about how deep they had to dig, the eeriness of the fact that they were digging in a corner of Pentonville Prison. When they actually exhumed the remains themselves, there's a very pointed remark made in the report about how respectful the men working on the remains were in terms of carrying the body to the chapel and the way they passed the prison, and there was kind of an eerie silence as they went along. So that kind of, I suppose, eyewitness account, it's very, very useful. There's also a really interesting remark made about the importance of having all the details recorded as accurately as possible. So, for example, the doctor that was present on site at the time said that he thought that the leg had been broken, or one of the leg bones that was exhumed had been broken, and there was a suggestion that this might be left out of the report just in case it could be proved that Casement never broke his leg and therefore there'd be some doubt about the identification of the body itself. But the remark is made that somebody in 50 years' time, this document might well be published, and it's as well for us to have all the facts out there as clearly as possible. And, of course, we publish it, I think, what, 52 years later. So, you know, you can see that kind of foresight and that historical foresight as well. And actually, when you were talking there earlier on about the documents that don't make the cut, there was a very, very interesting series of documents that we came across and that we had on our initial list about the potential publication of documents relating to the negotiations of the 1921 Anglo-Irish Treaty. And there's a back and forth going on between Lamass and some of the civil servants in the Department of the Taoiseach about whether or not this would be a good idea, would it cause difficulties with the British government in terms of their documents as well. And so you have this sense, not just in terms of, I suppose, the IFP giving you a picture of Irish foreign policy or Irish history through a diplomatic lens, but also the idea of the preservation of our history. And that's one of the things that kind of comes across, I think, in a lot of the documents, not just in Volume 12, that you see this kind of respect or this kind of interest in how do we protect and how do we, I suppose, frame the history. And that's an element, I think, of the volumes as well, is that these are high-level documents that are curated and brought forward by us to provide a starting point. They're a gateway into Irish foreign policy and the history of Irish foreign policy.
And Michael, going through the volume, you get a sense of the issues that the department and the government were preoccupied with. And one of them was the EEC, because a lot of documents about Irish attempts to join, the British failure to join, de Gaulle's press conference where it all falls apart for Britain, that there's quite a lot about the EEC in these documents.
This is the key to Irish foreign policy in the period. I mean, Eunan's point there about Lamass running the show and Aiken having his own area in New York at the UN to get involved in. Lamass wants Ireland into Europe. It's part of the whole Lamass program with Ken Whittaker in the Department of Finance to build the economy, to engender export-led growth. Ireland has to trade. The trading bloc we want to be part of is the EEC. And it's a very complicated process of negotiations where if you want to learn about how to negotiate with a group that basically have little enthusiasm, I mean, the six members of the EEC, as it was then, are not greatly enthusiastic about Ireland joining. And Ireland really has to convince the six, convince the European Commission that the country is up to it, that we're, you know, you have to remember how remote we were to continental Europe in the 1960s, how the fact that Britain applied for EEC membership and Ireland came in at the same time, and even though the application was independent, it was very much seen that Ireland was coming in or wanted to come in on Britain's coattails. And the view in Dublin was, well, the Commission is going to deal with Britain first, but they cannot forget about us. We have to convince them that we are serious about membership, that we're capable of membership. And there's a charm offensive by Lamass and his colleagues around the capitals of the six, and to the Commission to make sure that they learn who Ireland is. And there's a very interesting piece of footage on the European Commission website. You can see the first meeting between the Irish delegates led by Lamass and the members of the EEC. And the Irish are like the new boys in the class. They're sitting at the negotiating table, kind of not sure what to say. Con Cremin, the Sec Gen of the Department of External Affairs, is laughing nervously. Lamass is playing with his glasses. Jack Lynch is looking straight forward, and you know, Whitaker is wondering what to do. Whereas around them, the diplomats and the politicians who are members of the EC are talking, chatting amongst themselves. So it's overcoming that that Ireland has to do to get membership, to persuade the Europeans to open negotiations for membership of the EC for Ireland. And we do that. The Irish delegates manage, mainly through the achievements of our ambassador in Belgium, who's also accredited to the European Commission, Frank Bigger. Bigger, Lamass, Cremin, Whitaker, they're the team who convince the six, yes, open negotiations with Ireland. Now, it's not clear when the negotiations are going to begin. There's going to be stumbling blocks. But it's sorted out by October 1962. The chances are Ireland will be a member, Lamass thinks, of the EC by 1965. And then, bang, there's the De Gaulle press conference, 14th of January 1963, vetoing of Britain's application, and Ireland is out. Because if Ireland's not in, Britain's not going to be in. And then everything changes. It's back to the drawing board. Where do we go? What do we do? How do we become a member of the EC?
And it's very much tied into the view that this was about Ireland's place in the world, and EEC membership was going to be part of it, involvement in the UN and peacekeeping missions, and it was really about Ireland taking her place among the nations of the earth.
I mean, this is something I think that foreign policy in the early to mid-1960s really shows us, that Ireland has come of age internationally. Anglo-Irish relations, previously the mainstay of foreign policy, the national question, partition, all of this is part of a much broader series of foreign relations now. I mean, the diplomatic service itself is very small, but through the UN, we've broadened out the reach of countries that we're talking to, even though if we don't have resident missions there. And I think something we see in this volume is an increasing involvement with Africa, with the developing world, and with the agendas that we'd maybe be familiar with now of development aid, support for the individual, and making foreign policy much more global. I think that's really what's happening in this period for Ireland, that although the focus is transatlantic, European, there's a much broader reach there. Now, there are still areas we have no reach at all, like Eastern Europe, the Communist bloc, the Far East. But we're beginning to think outwards from the very narrow confines of British-Irish relations, and it's beginning to pay dividends. But there is a global perspective in Ivy House, I think, for the first time.
Okay, well, we're talking history, and tonight we're talking about Irish foreign policy in the first half of the 1960s. We're going to take a very quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be talking about peacekeeping in Cyprus, Northern Ireland, and spies and the Cold War. So stay with us here on News Talk.
Talking history on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. It's Valentine's Day, but we're not feeling particularly romantic after almost a year of the pandemic. So instead, we're looking at Irish foreign policy. In the first part of the 1960s, we have a brilliant panel of experts, Dr. Michael Kennedy, Professor Bernadette Whelan, Dr. John Gibney, Dr. Owen Kinsella, and Professor Eunan O'Halpin. And the occasion is the publication of Volume 12 of the Royal Irish Academy's Documents on Irish Foreign Policy, and it deals with the period 1961 to 1960. 65. And Eunan, during this period and in this volume, we get a great insight into Anglo-Irish relations. And we have Harold Wilson as the Prime Minister, who seems genuinely interested in Irish affairs. And you also get a great insight into North-South relations. So it's not just about Europe and America and the rest of the world.
I think that's very true. Alone of the people online, I'm old enough to remember when the Labour government came into power in 1964. And as a child, I was reading the Irish press and the Irish Times, and just from them I was indoctrinated with this belief that somehow Labour coming into government was going to be terrific for Ireland and implicitly for the sort of anti-partition cause. And yet one of the first things the Labour government do is to introduce tariffs which affect Ireland as well as other countries, and the Irish argue that this is in contravention of the 1938 Anglo-Irish Agreement, and ultimately negotiations lead to a kind of a fix through the establishment of the Anglo-Irish free trade area or whatever. But the point is that the British, when it suits their interests, Labour or Conservative, take unilateral action, whatever it says in the print of a treaty. And maybe Boris Johnson had seen the proofs of our volume when he introduced his measures, or threatened to, in his legislation last year. Because I think it shows that whatever the regime, whether it be Conservative, be Liberal, be Labour in Britain in the 20th century. They will act entirely and ruthlessly in British interests. So there was an element of delusion in the assumption that somehow a Labour government would in practice be more sympathetic to Irish nationalist aspirations relating to Northern Ireland, or even to the Irish economic wishes and so on, than the Conservatives had been.
And you get a good insight into Northern Ireland as well. And I think the huge work that Sean Lamass did to ensure that there was cooperation north and south and various attempts to kind of formalise that.
Well, you have it on the positive side, obviously, with the dramatic breakthrough, as it appeared at the time, of the Lamass-O'Neill meeting in January 1965, which, of course, comes as a surprise to Britain. If you look at the British records, as it does to the world. But you also have the ending, the petering out of the IRA's border campaign, which is formally ended in 1962. And one of the mysteries, really, of this period is how little that campaign impacted on wider Anglo-Irish relations, and how little, in fact, it appeared to impact at the time on conditions and even on inter-community relations within the North itself. If you think that within 8 years, with the Provo bombing campaigns that were, let's say, starting in 1970, the devastation that caused and the ramifications for Anglo-Irish relations, what's amazing is the absolute disappearance from Irish and from British concerns of militant republicanism, really by 1962. And in some ways, that's a gap in the records, because the IRA ceased to be a problem. And that in itself, I think, is very striking.
Bernadette, JFK also features in the volume, because this volume covers the visit of President Kennedy to Ireland. And of course, there are also meetings with Lamass in Washington, D.C. And Bobby Kennedy features that. You get very interesting insights into that dynamic.
Yeah, and you get a sense of the relationship that it's much more rounded than hitherto we would know. When we think about the period, it usually most people would just focus on JFK, the election, and obviously then the assassination. But when you look at the earlier volumes, and even you can go back to 1919, you get a sense of how that relationship, in some way, American-Irish relationship in particular, you get a sense of how there's change, but there's also continuity. And the continuities are how little Ireland features in American priorities, particularly after 1922 and the establishment of the Free State. And that really continues. And it's shored up a lot by the sense within and the reality within the State Department, which comes through very much in this volume, of how the primary relationship is that with Britain. And the Irish may think that they have a special relationship, but the real special relationship is that between Britain and the United States. And Kennedy himself, we have a lovely quote from Kiernan, who talked about that when he met him initially, that he thought he was more British than Irish. And yet, as we know, Kennedy very much focuses on his Irish background in order to get himself elected. But once in place, we find that the Ireland's place within the US Cold War priorities, within its sort of transatlantic strategic thinking, as I mentioned earlier, that Ireland it remains within the same low place, and that Ireland's position is really secondary and fourthly, fifthly, in relation, it's minor in relation to that special relationship, I'd say, which is the US-UK. And America's main ally is the United Kingdom. Now, where we do begin to see change then is that because Kennedy has Irish roots, because he is interested in Ireland, and he is interested in his background purely from a personal point of view, it has to be said, the State Department then is forced to begin to change and to alter its view in relation to where Ireland sits within US thinking. But there are other things related to what we've just been talking about. Because Ireland's position within the United Nations, where it has now established itself as a primary player in so many ways, not least in relation to peacekeeping, and then, as we mentioned earlier, it gets a seat on the council. You know, Ireland has become a player in international and multilateral terms. And I think that is another reason why it changes in terms of US priorities. And the other aspect of that then, of course, is you could think about in relation to the EEC. It's interesting to see changes which only come through in this volume. Initially, the Americans are very hesitant about that. They encourage Ireland to be part and to take membership of the European Economic Community. But they don't see that Ireland has much of a contribution to make in terms of promoting European integration. And T.K. Whittaker at one stage even suggests, might Ireland join NATO? So, you know, these are interesting little sidelines that come out of the volume and that really give a much more rounded picture, I think, of Ireland's relationship with these larger countries. Just to mention then, of course, the visit itself, that gives Kiernan in particular much greater access to the White House than really you could say any Irish ambassador had. And you could go right back even to perhaps to Michael McWhite in the 30s. And he is really interesting. He begins to talk with JFK about, you know, what's going to form the part of the visit and how is it going to be organized. And at one stage, JFK wondered whether he'd be asked to talk about partition. And Kiernan writes home and he says that JFK looked as if another headache had struck him because he didn't want to talk about partition, as we know, in any way. But at the same time, the visit itself, the preparation for it, and as we know, the visit itself was a milestone, particularly from an Irish perspective. It is particularly important. And where we see its importance really is not just the symbolism and the impact it has on Irish society, but the connections that are made between this modernising Ireland, which is what the Department of External Affairs and its officials abroad want to promote, and Lammas wants to promote. And this link between that and this youthful energy of JFK and JFK's America. So the global coverage that the visit gets is really the key to understanding, I think, in foreign policy terms, the importance of the visit. And some of us might even remember the edition of Time magazine in July 63, where Lammas is on the front cover, and the lead on it headline is, you know, Ireland new spirit in the old sod. And that is the type of message that they wanted to promote, that it is this country that is changing. And I think they do that quite successfully, albeit that after Kennedy is assassinated, access to the White House changes completely.
So it's not as clear cut then when LBJ is president that they don't have the same hopes and dreams for the close relationship.
Yeah, I mean, Kiernan makes a very, very, 4th of December 63, you know, so soon after the assassination. And he says that Johnson will be warm and friendly, but of course, without the depth of feeling. Now, he does feel able to express very forcefully to Kiernan on one of these St. Patrick Day visits, which is obviously still at the core of our soft diplomacy relationship with the US and is vital to it. He does encourage the Irish to take part in the peacekeeping efforts in Cyprus, which they had been kind of dithering over. And he's very forceful about that, as only he could be. The other final aspect I just mentioned is there's very unusual intervention by the Irish government with the American government about who Johnson was going to appoint to replace Matthew McLeod as the US ambassador. And what the Irish wanted was they wanted a career man. They didn't want any more of these political appointees, which of course had been the trend in US appointments to Ireland since the first Irishman, US minister Frederick Stirling. And of course, it would continue after that. So Raymond Geston, when he was appointed, he's greeted with great disappointment from an Irish perspective, at least.
John, it's also interesting that we see in this period that Ireland is looking further afield as well. It's not just about Europe. It's not just about the United States. It's also about the wider world. And we see increased contacts in Africa and various new contacts and relationships being established there.
One aspect of them that shouldn't be underrated is the extent to which you can actually see the nuts and bolts of how diplomacy and foreign policy and bureaucracies actually work, the practical problems they come across and have to encounter and try to overcome. And in this particular volume, you do see the expansion of Ireland's diplomatic network beyond, as you say, you know, continental Europe and North America. It's a period in which, you know, the Irish embassies would have been open and active in Africa for the first time, in Nigeria. Also, towards the end of the period covered by the volume, you would have the establishment of an Irish embassy in New Delhi. And there's also correspondence on, you know, how does one recognise or deal with diplomats from other countries, you know, even if you don't formally have diplomatic relations with them. I mean, Israel, countries in the Middle East, other countries that Irish diplomats might encounter through the United Nations or other international bodies. And it does show you in some ways the limits within which foreign policy can actually be conducted. It's actually striking. There's a striking contrast between, on the one hand, say the material about India and about Ireland. When we were going through it originally, it did seem that, you know, even in terms of the personalities of the people who were appointed to represent Ireland in those countries, you could see a distinction coming in the manner in which they reported them. I mean, the Irish ambassador to the first Irish ambassador to India doesn't seem to have been as proactive as, say, Ireland's his contemporary ambassador in Nigeria, Eamon Kennedy. And one fascinating series of documents that we came across, and that we couldn't, for reasons of space, we couldn't publish all of them, but we did publish selections from them, some of them, where this guy Kennedy going out and, like, quite literally touring around Nigeria to get a sense of, you know, well, what were the issues on the ground that were relevant in Nigeria? You know, trying to acquaint himself with its federal structure, with the political leaders and tribal leaders and community leaders in various parts of Nigeria. Trying to engage with the fact that the Irish missionary communities, the missionary, you know, endeavours in Nigeria as well, schools and so forth. And you got a sense of someone who's quite proactive. And as well as that, there's also a stream of a sequence of correspondence about, you know, essentially him writing back to Dublin complaining about the arrangements for the embassy in Nigeria, that he wasn't getting the kind of support that he necessarily wanted. And you do see, I mean, it's worth bearing in mind that these things don't, when you see foreign policy, it's not necessarily a rarefied thing that happens in a bubble. And it is important to get that sense of, you know, the very practical and real pressures that that diplomats face and that they try to overcome. And that's, I think that's especially pertinent in what were new embassies and countries that you had new Irish diplomatic missions in, because at this time you didn't really have many of them. You wouldn't have a real expansion of the Irish embassy network again in the 1970s, but you do see in the 60s kind of fragments of a certain sense that, you know, Ireland's interests were reaching out beyond the usual spheres of its neighbours and the United Nations that happened to become ensconced in the 1950s.
And Owen, a few times you get a sense of the Cold War going on all around as well, that there's mentions of Russian spies and there's various concerns. So occasionally we do see the Cold War impinging on some of these diplomats.
That's right. It's not a major theme of the volume, but it's something that threads quite subtly throughout the documents. And obviously Ireland isn't a major player in the Cold War, and it's not a battleground. It's not a place where there'd be a lot of espionage, etc., happening. But, you know, to pick up on something that Bernadette was talking about earlier on in terms of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when that erupts or when that emerges, you know, Lamass is very quick to assure the Americans of Irish support. But both Lamass and Aiken, they're both absent from Dublin in late October, just as this is happening. So they let Sheila Murphy, who was Assistant Secretary at the Department of External Affairs in Dublin at the time, to handle the initial response. So there were multiple requests from the US, from Britain and Canada, copies of all the manifest data and for search to be made of all the Cuban and Eastern Bloc flights that were landing at Shannon on their way to Cuba. And that kind of raised some fairly delicate legal questions regarding sort of Irish authority to actually search international traffic under international treaties. Now, luckily, that crisis is resolved before that we have to make any serious decisions on that, but it was something that made us slightly uncomfortable. And just a few months later then, in February 1963, you have a Soviet trawler which is registered in Latvia that gets arrested and brought into Waterford for fishing illegally in Irish territorial waters. And this actually raises a very delicate question for the Department of Foreign Affairs as well, because they don't want to recognize the Soviet annexation of Latvia. So because of the fact that this trawler is registered in Latvia, they have to word their response to any Soviet correspondence on the issue very, very carefully to not give it that kind of recognition by implication. And again, just a little bit later on then, in the final days of 1963, you have the Department of Justice writing the Department of External Affairs to say that one Russian third secretary at the embassy in London, who had spent some time in Dublin, was actually a major in the Russian intelligence service and had been observed acting suspiciously in Dublin, and sort of to warn Con Kremen, who was the Irish ambassador in London, that Zilsov had to be treated with a lot of circumspection and that he shouldn't really be dealt with any further. So you do get that sense that the Cold War is there, that we're on the fringes, I suppose, of the battle itself. But more importantly, I think that the main thrust of Irish foreign policy in the 60s is nuclear non-proliferation and the reduction of the threat of nuclear war. And that kind of comes to fruition in, at the UN in 1961, early 1961, when the Irish Resolution is passed, which again sort of commits most of the signatories to reducing their nuclear arsenals. And that's followed up again by the Test Ban Treaty in 63, which we're one of the signatories of as well. So it's there, and it's a constant presence, I think, within the volume itself, but not, I suppose, a major theme.
I know, and we also get some wonderful documents on the resignation of Conor Cruise O'Brien from the diplomatic service, and things got quite heated then.
Yeah, it's something that comes across, and I think a lot of these came from the UCD archives as well, the Frank Aiken papers there, and you can see the kind of the disintegration of the close relationship between O'Brien and his importance, I suppose, to the Irish Department of External Affairs. The aftermath of Katanga, and I suppose the sort of the circumstances around O'Brien's actions there, you can see these kind of unravel slowly, and there's a very definite sense on O'Brien's part that he has been left out to dry by not just by other countries at the UN, but also by Fred Boland, who's Ireland's ambassador to the UN as well. He's very unhappy with that, and things escalate quite quickly, and his resignation comes in quite quickly, whereas Aiken would like him to come back and to serve in the Department of External Affairs in Ireland, at least initially before he decides what to do next. O'Brien reacts quite strongly, goes to the press with a lot of different allegations, and then writes his letter of resignation to Aiken.
Michael Kennedy, it's a peacekeeping mission that I think perhaps doesn't get as much attention as it deserves, and that's the peacekeeping mission to Cyprus.
Cyprus is very much a reaction, or our participation in Cyprus is a reaction to what Owen was talking about there about Congo and about Cold War. And Congo is a kind of a Cold War crisis that really burns the UN, and in terms of the peacekeeping mission there, burns Ireland as well. And as a result, the next time the UN looks to Ireland to send battalions of infantry to a peacekeeping mission, Frank Aiken is not so sure. He's been given the runaround by Youth Hant, Hammarskjöld's successor as Secretary General, over the Cruise O'Brien's resignation and a number of other things. And when trouble flares in Cyprus in the late 50s, early 60s, Aiken is very slow to participate when the UN wants to step in, because he's worried that Britain, Greece and Turkey are trying to promote a partition of the island, and that if Irish peacekeepers go to Cyprus, they will be part of a force partitioning the island. And Ireland will never support partition internationally because of Northern Ireland and the partition of Ireland. And so to have Irish troops involved in a peacekeeping mission that supported the partition of any entity is anathema to Frank Aiken. And he writes to Youth Hant, he writes to the UN Secretariat, looking for guarantees, saying that Ireland will withdraw its battalion of troops, the 40th Battalion, if partition is attempted. And it's part of this, I think Eunan was talking about it earlier, that the Frank Aiken, Sean Lamass relationship at the centre of the volume, that Lamass takes Aiken aside and said, Frank, in synopsis, Frank, cop on. You can't write letters threatening the UN Secretary General that you'll do this, that and the other, and asking him to tell you that he will do this. You know, stand back, calm down. And the two men, I mean, their relationship is difficult at times. But over Cyprus, over the dispatch of infantry to Cyprus, you see that the relationship, how it develops, and how Lamass has the upper hand, as he always has, because Frank Aiken is the loyal lieutenant, as he has been to De Valera beforehand. And so troops are sent to Cyprus in April 1964. And in terms of peacekeeping itself, it's a very important departure for peacekeeping. We tend to think of Lebanon as the main kind of mission after Congo, after Katanga. But Cyprus is a very important mission for the defense forces in terms of implementing the lessons learned in the Congo, buying up-to-date equipment, buying up-to-date weapons, learning how to deploy correctly, and taking the experience of operating in an environment about which you know very little, and learning from it and developing operating procedures and learning how to deal with the UN itself, because peacekeeping was such a new concept in the 1960s. Congo was really the first major peacekeeping mission that the UN got involved in. We leave Congo in late 1963, early 64, and then troops are straight away back into Cyprus in 1964, where they serve up until the 1970s, into some extent much later.
And Michael, we began by talking about Ireland on the UN Security Council. Was there ever a danger that Ireland might even leave the United Nations during this period?
Well, this is a very interesting series of documents that we found that Frank Aiken gets very annoyed in 64, 65 about the contribution that member states are making to the UN itself, or not making in some cases, in particular the Soviet Union and France. And he's worried about the way peacekeeping missions are being paid for or not being paid for. And in an internal discussion with the secretary of the Department of External Affairs, who now is Hugh McCann, Con Kremen having gone off to London, Aiken says to McCann, you know, we may even have to consider leaving the UN if we can't get it to sort out its finances, if we can't get it to sort out this question over the payment of peacekeeping. McCann minutes it. We've every reason to think that he was serious, at least at that moment, as it was written down. And it's one of these issues in UN policy that means a huge amount to Frank Aiken. He really sees the UN and its charter as the cornerstone of Irish foreign policy, and the UN by extension as the only hope for world peace within that Cold War context and that Owen was talking about earlier.
Well, a very interesting point indeed, and a good note on which to end our discussion on Volume 12 of Documents on Irish Foreign Policy. And my thanks to the brilliant team behind Volume 12 for joining me tonight. A superb panel: Dr. Michael Kennedy, Professor Bernadette Whelan, Dr. John Gibney, Dr. Owen Kinsella, and Professor Eunan O'Halpin. Well, that brings us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together: Susan Cattle, my producer, and Peter Malloy on sound. Next week, we'll find out about the mixtape NASA sent into space in the 1970s as our message to the galaxy, the life and times of an Irish adventurer in South America in the 19th century, and the terrible impact of an IRA atrocity during the Troubles. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.
Talking History on News Talk.